Good morning.
Good morning, everybody.
I'm Blair Centella. I'm an attorney. I practice here in the Atlanta area.
I'm Kurt Opsahl. I'm the Deputy General Counsel of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a nonprofit that is dedicated to defending your rights online. Thanks. Thank you. And we're here to talk about warrant canaries.
And what are warrant canaries? So, anyone know what a warrant canary is?
Basically, it's primarily a web page where a site can say we have not been asked for given a warrant for any policing as of this date, and they can keep updating it daily. And the day they get a warrant, then stop updating it and not overtly speak of the warrant to be not being issued.
Right. I mean, that's basically it. I mean, the theory, at least, behind it is that, first of all, stepping back, is that some kinds of legal process have gag orders attached to them. For example, a national security letter is a letter that the FBI can issue to a service provider that requires them to give up information about one of their customers and also never tell anybody that they have received the letter, and the FBI has issued, you know, hundreds of thousands of these letters. There are other kinds of process, like from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, a FISA order also comes with a gag. You're not allowed to tell anybody about it. But the notion is that you're under no obligation until you get one of these. You feel free to say that you have never received one of these legal processes because there's no gag attached at that point. And then when you do get one, it puts right at issue this question of, can the government compel you to lie? To lie to your customers and say that you haven't received something when you in fact have received it. No court has addressed warrant canaries directly. There have been a number of cases on compelled speech. And generally, the courts have found that it's the government can't compel you to speak something that you don't want to say. And there are a few exceptions to that, mostly in the context of commercial speech. Like the warnings on cigarette packs, for example, the cigarette companies didn't want to put those warnings on there, but it was commercial speech. And it was a truthful warning to consumers, and then the litigation about them has actually been a lot about whether they were there was a rational relationship between what they were asking them to say and the government interest, and whether they were truthful. There was another case dealing with the Planned Parenthood. They had a law that said they had to tell people who were coming for an abortion that if you had an abortion, you had a greater degree of suicide ideation. And Planned Parenthood challenged that and was unsuccessful because they weren't able to show that this wasn't truthful speech. And so this suggests that a court would not be able to compel you to lie. And therefore, they couldn't compel you to continue having the warrant canary up even after you've received the thing. So at some point or another, we'll find out whether that works. There are a number of companies that have put out warrant canaries, big and small. Like, for example, I have a list here of some of them, but like Apple, for example, has said in the transparency report that Apple has never received an order under Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act. And so I guess we'll look at their next transparency report and see if that statement's still there.
And what I passed around, or what I'm passing around, is a sample national security letter. And what those are authorized, or I guess written under, is 18 USC 2709. Which is part of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. And that statute has kind of a sordid history. Back in 2004, I believe, was the first case. Not one there is from 2004, it's from that case. And essentially, the statute as it was written at that time, this is sort of the flip side to the warrant canary. This is what warrant canaries are aimed at sort of combating. But the statute prohibited the ISP from disclosing the fact that they had received this national security letter. And so it was actually a federal crime to disclose it to their consumer. And there was no oversight pretty much whatsoever. There's no way the subscriber could challenge the letter if they thought that the information was overbroad, that it was seeking, or anything along those lines. So, over the last 10 years, the EFF and other organizations like the ACLU have represented these plaintiffs, challenging these subpoenas. But for a time there were serious questions about, whether even talking to an attorney would be a crime under the reading of the statute. And luckily, there were two decisions back in 2006, I think, where the courts in Connecticut and New York held that the statute was unconstitutional, so it sort of immunized those plaintiffs. But up until that decision was rendered, they were under fear that, by talking to an attorney, they could be committing a crime. So,
yeah, now it is certainly clear that if you ever get a national security letter, you can feel free to talk to an attorney about it.
Right.
And please do, because you'll want an attorney for that. They changed the statute after that, made some modifications to it. So it went. So the statute continued along to sort of attempting to resolve that ruling. More recently, in a case that my organization brought in 2013, we had a court declare the statute to be unconstitutional under the First Amendment because of the gag order provision. That decision was stayed pending appeal. The government, as expected, did appeal. And that actually, I'm going to be arguing that in early October, a little over a month from now.
That was from the Eastern District of California, I believe.
Northern District.
Or Northern District, mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's going to be argued before the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeal. So we are hopeful that the court will uphold the decision, and then we'll see if the government wants to take it all the way up, or will stop there. They do an interesting thing. There are a number of different circuits. We're in the 11th Circuit now, and if they lose in one circuit, sometimes they say, you know what, I don't want to risk it. And so they'll just apply that decision within the states of that circuit and say that it doesn't apply to any of the other states and be able to go about their business most of the time. But we think they probably will not be satisfied with the Ninth Circuit because it includes California, where most of the service providers are.
And there's also there was a big issue about subpoenas. Twitter was subpoenaed, and I don't believe that was a national security letter situation, but I believe it was just under a different section. But basically, the government was seeking the Twitter information for various people allegedly associated with WikiLeaks. And so there's a huge issue there about First Amendment, freedom of speech and that kind of thing. I think the EFF was part of that as well.
We were.
Right.
Twitter has actually somewhat unusually for service providers, in some instances, actually fought back against subpoenas directly. For a lot of the service providers, they leave it up to the end user to fight back or not. But in some cases, Twitter has actually gone for it, which I've appreciated.
So I came across a statistic where there are up to like 20-something thousand of these NSLs issued every year. And so, over the years, there's been like three or four major lawsuits. So just you can kind of imagine the sheer number of people who don't contest or don't know, or don't ever find out about it. So a vast majority of the companies out there aren't sticking up for their users' rights and aren't taking it to court. So that gives you an idea of the scope of...
And sometimes a single national security letter will be for information about lots of users. So the number of letters is just a clue as to the number of people that have been affected.
Yeah. Any questions so far?
Is it just because it's easier to go along?
I think for a lot of these companies, just you know, easy enough to do a quick response, and they're not really that interested in trying to fight for the users, or you know, you also, I mean, they are under some pressure. The government is, with a national security letter, is at least implicitly saying that this is an emergency. You know, these are terrorists. We got to find out who they are. Now, I don't really believe that there are hundreds of thousands of terrorists in the United States that they are all really needed these to track down. And there's not very much evidence that they've actually been all that effective. But nevertheless, that is the kind of pressure that is being put on some of these service providers. There are some instances where, though, it went really, really, really far in terms of cooperation. For a while, and this came out in a Inspector General report. You know, each division, like the Department of Justice, has an Inspector General, which is supposed to, you know, look for abuse. And eventually, they did a report about NSLs, and they looked at some practices. One of which, there was an embedded person from various phone companies who sort of worked out of the Department of Justice. So for extra convenience for giving them NSLs. But then it got like more and more convenient. Then they have to say, well, you know, we're going to type up the NSL, but could you just give us the information now and we'll get you the NSL later. And eventually that devolved into things like if the person was away from their desk, they would leave a phone number on a post-it note and then they would just get the information about that phone number. And so from a letter that should be signed by the, you know, special agent in charge and, you know, has a bunch of, they have to certify that this is true and that is true, down to a post-it note. And then the IG, the Inspector General, found that, and they weren't even following up with all the NSLs. Like, once they got the information, it wasn't a really high priority to go ahead and, like, type this whole thing up and get somebody to certify it. So they ended up not doing that. And that was a bit scandalous when it came out. The box here in the front.
Quick question. If under whatever amount of investigation one can actually do after being served a note, if you can show that it's somebody's personal vendetta, that they're after you for something they couldn't find you before, still don't have info, but now they have leverage to dig it out, or maybe say, a girlfriend's ex-husband happens to have the power to harass you, so he does. If you're able to actually show enough of this so that they leave you alone, are they allowed to gag you so that you can't publish this story after the fact?
Well, so a national security letter, the part of the problem is it's not going to you, it's going to the service provider. And the service provider has no idea whether it's your, you know, ex or whatever who is behind this. Mm-hmm. Though that sort of abuse, we have seen that in some circumstances. The NSA, there were instances of what they called love int when people were looking up their former spouses and such. So far, there hasn't been a record of that sort of abuse with the national security letters. By and large, what you do with them is you have like a phone number and you want to know the name of the account number. You have an email address and you want to know what IP number was used to access that email address last. And then you go to the service provider that provides their connectivity and you say, I have this IP address. Who is the account holder? So if you want to, you know, find out about your ex-girlfriend, you usually know, you know, what their name is and such. So it's not as, I mean, I guess you want to find out who they're dating now. Maybe you need this, but there are other ways that they can go about that sort of thing.
If you're like the next guy after she dumped him,
yeah.
He's got an
extra. But, I mean, it did get pretty bad with these post-it notes and such, and maybe there was that kind of abuse. But if it follows the procedures properly, I mean, they do have to get the special agent in charge to sign off on it. So, you know, you might feel a little bit nervous about trying to put that past your SAC.
Just
speak into the top
okay,
of the box.
The microphone. Okay. The notification process that this gag order is basically just the ISP saying we've got one or not. There would be no further information trickling down to the objects of the surveillance.
Well, so that's the case that we have is actually, you know, we represent two different service providers, can't say who they are because that's the crux of the case. All they want to say is that they received a national security letter. They want to be able to talk about, as with sort of the gravitas of being a recipient, and talk about the problem of national security standards by saying, you know, we're a company that's received one, and we are opposed to it. But they can't say that. Not for talking specifically to about the end user, but even to say that they've got one, and apparently that would be the end of civilization as we know it. So the government is fighting hard against that.
And the thing is, it's of infinite duration as well. So that was one of the things the courts pointed out, is that there's no end point. You know, it's supposed to be relevant to an investigation, but there's no termination date. So the government's essentially implying that the investigation continues forever. And the person's gagged forever from mentioning that there was ever a security letter. So
bring the box up front.
Oh.
It's a microphone.
Okay. Hello, box. when one of these companies, they have, it sounds like they have a statement out there saying, we've never received a subpoena from the government on collecting information, and then they take the letter down if they get one. Can they have one of those for every single account user, and they would take them down individually, or is it a global thing where every single company's probably have one of these once a year?
So a lot of companies do transparency reports, and this is actually a growing trend. It used to be somewhat rare, and now it's getting a little bit more commonplace. And they'll say, we have received, 132 subpoenas, 24 warrants, and then they might say, and zero national security letters, and zero FISA orders. And then the next one might not have that line. The government does now, after there's been a lot of controversy, a lot of national security stuff is in the news, they actually have changed their policy and said, you can give a range. So you can say that you've received between 0 and 999 national security letters, or 1,000 to 1,999, and so on, ranges of 1,000. But yes, anyway, getting to your point, I have not seen anybody who has done it in an individualized fashion. One of the things that would be an interesting challenge is if it looks like eventually this is going to go before a court, and what I would like to see at least is a court saying that you can have a warrant canary, and that you can say that have something that says you have no national security process, and then remove that. But it probably will look best to the court if it is something that is done in a fashion where it's focused on trying to be transparent and honest about the kinds of process you've received. And something which is very individualized to the account gets really to the heart of what the government is worried about, which is notifying somebody that they are under investigation, that it will be that this is a suspect for some sort of either terrorism or other criminal activity in some cases. And so that's going to be something that's more persuasive to a court, that they would have to stop, that if you had an individualized one and removed it there, that was in effect attempting to tell that person, even though you were gagged from doing so.
You've talked about these transparency reports. Is there any clearinghouse or website that combines all these together so you can do a quick check of your service providers?
Not really. There are some, on our website, we have a collection of warrant canaries that we have identified, and there are links to the transparency reports involved in those, but I have not seen something which is an overall collection of all transparency reports.
So if you were to make a website that automatically monitors the stuff, and you got the companies to actually report on a daily or quarterly basis, do you think the jurisprudence would be against that because it's more of an automated manner and more likely to be clear of what's happening?
Well, I mean, if the companies did that, you know, to try and make it so it was an automated notice that would sort of ping when it was removed, then that's a lot like trying to tell people about it. But if some third party did it and, you know, they had nothing to do with it, you can't really pin it on the company. One thing I would say, you know, say on a daily or whatever basis, and I actually am hopeful that the first time it comes in the court, it's going to be something where the next report is going to come out several months later, so that you can brief it for the court and argue it and have that discussion before it comes due. Because sometimes, even if you go to a court and this is either going to like happen or not happen the next day, and the government's saying national security is at stake, there'll be blood on your hands if you don't do this, well, courts tend to not want to take the bold move under those circumstances. They're going to listen a lot to the government. So if we're going to have a ruling that really considers the issue and has time for briefing and argument, it's going to be best if it's not in an emergency fashion. So I've been encouraging people who do warrant canaries to have it be at a little bit of a longer time frame than a daily canary.
In cases where subscribers are not notified and information is distributed, do criminal charges follow? And if so,
to the end user?
To the end user. And if so, how would that individual be able to challenge an unconstitutional search if they are not aware of the search to begin?
So you're absolutely identifying a problem. So in many circumstances where it is a criminal investigation, you don't find out about it ahead of time, perhaps because there's a gag order, perhaps because the ISP is not one of those that notifies its users. But then eventually you get, you know, arrested and charged, and then you can you try and exclude the fruits of that search because, you know, you say it was an unconstitutional search, that evidence can't be used against me. That doesn't stop them from having that information, but you can at least make your arguments about it. But what about the circumstances in which they rifled through all your stuff, looked in your life deeply, and then found out that actually you were just a perfectly ordinary guy and there was nothing there, and then you might never know? And that is kind of a troubling circumstance, and this is why, you know, we really encourage service providers to provide notice. And it's kind of interesting, in the ordinary course of things, they don't get a gag order, but they will write on the subpoena, just a grand jury subpoena, something like that, we're asking you not to notify the end user. And sometimes they will sort of obscurely reference obstruction of justice, and they'll say something about, like, you know, please don't do anything that would obstruct justice, trying to imply, like, notifying the user would be a criminal charge under obstruction of justice, which is not. And there's actually a procedure in the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, ECPA, for them to go and get an order from the court to gag it. And if they don't get that, then I think that the service provider should notify the end user and just tell the government, look, you know, if you think that this is one of the circumstances in which notice should be prohibited, go to the court and prove your case. Don't just ask me to not notify because you think it'll disrupt your investigation.
Should we feel consoled by the congressman, I forget who it was, who said that if no one knows your privacy is violated, then you can't complain about being violated?
Yeah, Mike Rogers. Now he's leaving Congress to go become a radio host, I believe. But in any event, yeah, so he said, well, it doesn't matter. You know, your privacy is not violated if you don't know if a tree falls in a forest. I just disagree. I think, you know, the privacy is the right to be left alone. And you're not being left alone if somebody is rifling through your stuff, even if they don't do anything about it, even if you don't directly find out about it. Because some of the violation is that possibility that someone will find things about you, take them out of context, and use them against you. And if the government knows all the information about all the people, they can do that pretty easily.
Yep.
I mean, at one time there was the whole forbidden fruit of
fruit of the poisonous
tree doctrine or whatnot. So if they were to rifle through everything because you have to have an Arabic last name or whatever, and there was an emergent circumstance, but they found out that you had five stolen library books under your second couch, and they just happened to pass this information over to somebody else so that they would know where to conveniently look in your next house overturning. Do you have any defense against that? I mean, clearly you wouldn't know how they found that information, but if it came to you somehow.
Well, this is talking a little bit about parallel construction. So parallel construction is a fascinating concept where the government obtains information in one manner, sometimes through like the NSA surveillance or some other means, that they don't want to reveal how they got this information. So they'll pass it along to another agency. This came into the news because of information being passed to the DEA. And then the DEA will figure out a way where they might have gotten that information anyway, right? And then when they arrest you and charge you and such, it will be presented as if they independently discovered it. So they just sort of are really lucky and happen to know where to look, or, you know, maybe they got an anonymous tip or something like that. And the parallel construction enables the government to hide the source of things. And this became kind of a weird problem, actually. At one point, the Solicitor General, and that's the officer in the Department of Justice who argues before the Supreme Court, said that the fruits of some of the NSA surveillance were not being used in criminal cases, and then had to, when some information came out that, in fact, this parallel construction was going on, had to write a letter of apology to the court for lying to it, which is just sort of astounding that the Solicitor General would lie to the Supreme Court. Any more questions?
I mean, this is kind of a broader issue too, I think. Just, there's other statutes that allow them to obtain information without any notice. So I just wrote down a quick list regarding mail, so they can obtain, you know, the outside of any letters that are sent throughout the postal system, but they need a warrant to get to open sealed letters. Pen registers, which kind of collect the to and from information for phone calls, there's no notice requirement for that either. So that's another thing. Those can be renewed for 60 days. Wiretaps actually require, which is collecting the content of conversations, phone conversations or whatnot, those actually do require a warrant. And then FISA, as we've already been talking about. So there's a whole like litany of different statutes that kind of allow the government to obtain all this different type of information. Some allow prior notice, some don't. Some require a warrant, some don't. And so the issue with the NSL is they're sort of an administrative subpoena, so it's a government agency. So the big issue in the courts was whether there's any sort of judicial review, because a warrant isn't required, and it's an administrative subpoena. That's a type of subpoena that is very expedited, and someone in the agency signs off and just sends it out. It's supposed to be more informal, but it was implicating, you know, these big constitutional rights and such. So I believe there's a question.
You indicated earlier that a wiretap, for example, requires a warrant, but are you aware of any having been performed without a warrant? And what can you tell us about the kinds of warrants that are approved as sort of de rigueur? They are reviewed by a private court and the records are not public.
So on the first question, are there wiretaps that occur without a warrant? Well, there's the NSA wiretapping program. So that would be a large category of wiretaps that are occurring without a warrant. And in addition, you know, sometimes there have been other instances in which somebody hasn't gone through a warrant to get a wiretap. Like Rogers, the police are overreaching. But that's fairly rare for like ordinary police departments. For the most part, the telcos are, they have processes in place, and they will require that you have the appropriate level of process for various things. One of the sort of interesting areas, though, is when they're trying to get your email. And under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, it's kind of a weird statute because it says for email that is under 180 days old, they have to get a warrant, but if it's over 180 days, they can get it with just a subpoena. So they go ahead and try and get it without a warrant, getting to the content of communications if it's old. And this is because the statute was written in a time where people did not have like Gmail accounts where they'll have years and years of correspondence. It was written during a time of bulletin board systems in the mid-80s, where it would be sort of unusual to leave your mail on the system for more than 6 months because the technology was collecting it and deleting it when someone read it. So a circuit court in the Sixth Circuit found that that was unconstitutional, that the Fourth Amendment did require a warrant for email, even though the statute allowed it under a subpoena. And so the Department of Justice, rather than take that up to the Supreme Court, this is what I was kind of getting at earlier, they apply that rule only in the Sixth Circuit. And so they get a warrant in the Sixth Circuit, and elsewhere they try to get things with a subpoena. But I think they're not very confident in this rule. Twice now in other jurisdictions, we've come in to represent somebody who was information or the content of their emails was being requested with a subpoena. And then as soon as we showed up, they said, you know what, we'll get a warrant. Don't worry about it. And that means that they can go ahead for situations in which the person doesn't know about it and get the information with the subpoena, but when there's a chance of a case, they're not willing to see what the court would rule.
I just thought of a situation that seems to kind of be the flip side of this, but with the Stingray cell phone data collection, I've heard that there have been, I think, like, federal gag orders against local police departments, or maybe it was corporate requests for that from the manufacturers to keep local police forces from revealing that they even have used the device. Can you, like, say, either talk a little bit about that?
So I know a little bit about that. I believe out in Florida there was some Freedom of Information Act or whatever the sort of the Florida state equivalent of that transparency law, where someone tried to get information about how the stingrays were being used, and then the DEA went and essentially seized the documents from that agency and pulled them back to headquarters. So then the agency was like, hey, well, we don't have them anymore, we can't give them to you. And that seemed to be like a bit much. And the theory, I believe, was that this was sort of proprietary trade secret information of the manufacturer. But I don't know that very deeply. So
there was also another situation out in Washington State. I just saw the other day a news article or a news video about this. But they are claiming that they only use this Stingray after they obtain a warrant. But I know there's a lot of concern about just the search and seizure possibility, you know, to that be construed or just sucking up all the information with those Stingray devices. So I kind of look at it like, well, what is it actually obtaining? It's obtaining the to and from information. And so, like, under the pen register statute, you know, it's not going through those requirements. I mean, police are just using those devices to obtain that information. So it's sort of unique in the cell phone context because it's not just a landline where you actually have to go to a telco to get the information. You know, it's sort of like, well, there's this neat device we could buy it from this company off the internet for a police department, you know, that could help out. So let's just buy it. And it's a pretty sophisticated device, I believe. But basically, it acts as a cell phone tower, and it tricks phones into sort of interacting with it, and then it can gather information about the phone, its GPS location, just like a cell phone tower would to in order to make a phone call and stuff. So
your cell phone is going to associate with sort of the strongest signal. And so if you have something which is closer to you and a stronger signal than the actual cell tower, it is essentially is a man in the middle between you and your phone call. And so you think that, or your phone thinks that it's talking to the real cell tower when in fact it's talking to the Stingray.
Do they want you one?
Well, I think they should, but they should get an appropriate legal process.
There's also an issue kind of related to that with Google. I believe it was over in Europe where Google is driving around sucking up all the passwords from the wireless network.
I don't know if they were getting the password. I think you're talking about when they were doing the Street View?
Yeah, they were getting all this information, and they actually had to settle a lawsuit or something. But
so what Blair is talking about is when the Google Street View cars were going around, they were also simultaneously looking at the Wi-Fi signals that they could find from people's various wireless routers. And the reason for that is that for their Google Maps product, if they know what IP, you know, what wireless access point your phone is associated with, and then they know where that is from their car, they can give you sort of more accurate location information. At least that was what their story was. And they actually, though, were collecting a lot more information, you know, collecting some of the communications that were coming out of these wireless access points. Google claims that was a coding error, was a mistake. So yeah, they got sued over that, and the court held that was illegal. Though I would actually say I have some troubles with how the ruling came about, because it had some odd conclusions of it. It was saying that the reason why this was not okay was that this was not a radio communication. And, you know, for most sort of common understandings of what a radio communication is, a wireless access point is, in fact, a radio communication. So there's some weirdness about the ruling that actually I do find troubling.
The presumption of privacy?
So these were open Wi-Fi signals, so they weren't going into encrypted signals, but were looking at the packets that were coming out of open Wi-Fi. And not into the content of the packets, but they were getting the addressing and to-from information. And there's actually a number of good reasons why security researchers will want to look at that sort of that information. And, you know, frankly, actually, your phone is, whenever you have it in the Wi-Fi mode and, you know, it's looking for something nearby, it's looking at those packets, looking at whether or not this is one of the Wi-Fi routers you've previously been associated with, and if so, it will try and connect you. So if the court's ruling is actually taken very literally, then there's a lot of other people who are doing ordinary tasks that might get swept up into it.
It seems like we're suffering from a pretty significant gulf between the complexity of the technology and the laws that govern it. Is there any immediate point at which either the courts will declare or Congress will codify into law the concept that digital communications qualify as papers under the Fourth Amendment? And do you think that's even going to be helpful?
Well, on the first part of your question, the law is being outdated. Yeah, this is how it works. It takes a lot longer to change a law than it does to change technology. And I mean, we have, as I said, the, you know, ECBA came around in 86. It's been updated a couple of times since then. But like, even in the best possible case, a law is going to be based on the concepts of technology that exist at the moment of passage and how some people in Congress think technology might evolve in the near future. And congressional critters are not particularly good futurists, and so, you know, they often are not guessing the future correctly. So things get outdated, and then they say, oh, they wait until there's a problem, and then the laws will change again. But on the sort of the second part, you know, will the courts come to think of digital communications as kinds of communications as like papers in the Fourth Amendment sense? I mean, we are seeing more of that. We're seeing that very significantly in the recent U.S. v. Riley decision. This was the decision where the court held that a warrant was necessary to search your phone incident to arrest, they recognizing the difference between the sort of papers that you might carry around in your pocket and how much information was on your phone, that your whole life was on your phone. The court in that decision was, you know, making the comparison like, you know, previously it wasn't possible or, you know, practical. You could, I guess, have a trunk, the court said, where you carried around every letter you had ever received and walked around with it, but, you know, no one would actually do that. But now you can and do that every day with your phone, and the court was recognizing these important differences. So that decision came out a couple months ago and really gives me a lot of hope that the Supreme Court is getting more aware of technology.
And that decision was sort of following, well, a while after this previous decision regarding the third-party doctrine. And we mentioned that in one of the other panels, but basically it's the idea that when you give information voluntarily to someone else, that you give up any expectation of privacy, which has constitutional implications, you know. So essentially in that case, Smith v. Maryland, it involved a pen register like I mentioned. So that was just involving the to and from information for something, for a phone call, I believe. But now, you know, with this new decision, there's a lot more room for lawyers, whoever, to argue that, you know, the Supreme Court has recognized that that decision may be outdated and says it's not as simple as just saying, you know, you've given your information to a third party, therefore you don't have any expectation of privacy in it. So like a cell phone is hugely different than just like the pen register involved in Smith v. Maryland, for example. But there is actually a lot of, you know, a lot of, I guess a line of cases is the way to put it, holding that this third-party doctrine applies in kind of a variety of contexts. So there was a Jones v. United States decision, I believe that was the name of it, where one of the concurrences alluded to the fact that the Supreme Court may have to revisit this third-party doctrine. So, and then the Riley decision came out after that and sort of discussed those concepts but didn't directly confront that issue with that previous precedent. So. You know, along those lines, that's kind of how, you know, in the court system, that evolving technology is being addressed. But legislatively, I think more can be done for sure to address that kind of stuff. So,
all right. Any other questions? I mean, I guess we got a little off track from the warrant canaries, getting to sort of a general discussion of surveillance. But
that's my fault, Tim.
Okay, two questions here. Well, I think he hasn't spoken yet, so.
If you were going to store your data with any given provider, which one would it be?
I mean, it depends on the sort of data and how much I care about it. If I care about it a lot, with none. If I don't care about it very much, look for providers that have good security, that have, so there's actually two reports on our website that you might look at. One is our Who Has Your Back report, and this lists about 25 service providers and six categories about how they respond to government surveillance requests. And so, you know, look for the ones with six stars there. And then we also have the Encrypt the Web report, looking at the same set of service providers, and in that case there were five questions about the security systems they use in terms of encrypting your information, whether they encrypt by default, whether they encrypt between data centers. That's also important for protecting against passive surveillance.
I think one of the things too, like these technologies are kind of coming out more recently as well because of the NSA stuff. So I believe there's one Kurt and I talked about called Silent Circle. Mm-hmm. I mentioned dark mail, was it?
Well, they're the two different things.
Yeah, the two different things, right.
Silent Circle, dark mail.
Right, and one of them is kind of being headed up by the Lavabit guy, Ladar Levinson, who's actually involved in a federal case, criminal case now. Because he refused to turn over information that was encrypted, essentially. So, and while that case is pending, he's continuing to work on these technologies, I guess. Because of those disclosures, NSA stuff, you know, a lot of companies are coming out with that. Like dark mail would be one to watch for. But it's hard pressed to think of one that right now is just really secure. And I've looked at that as well, because as an attorney, I have to do my best to protect attorney-client privilege and stuff. So.
Dark mail and Silent Circle, these are encrypted phone applications, so you can download them to your phone and then make a encrypted phone call to someone else who has the same service. So the downside is they don't interact with the regular telephone system, so it's only useful for talking to people who do that. Dark mail is attempting to be a encrypted email service. For email, actually, I prefer GNU Privacy Guard, GNU Privacy Guard. That is a open source free add-on that implements an encrypted protocol. Also has the same feature, though. You have to be communicating with someone else who has this. That's pretty much necessary for encrypted communications, that the other person will have it. Though, one sort of interesting one is if any of you have iPhones, iMessage automatically encrypts end-to-end to anyone else with iMessage, and a lot of people out there have iPhones, so you guys may have been actually having encrypted text communications without even realizing it. And I think you were talking a little bit more about storage systems. So one thing you can do with a storage system, I mean, as I said, look at the report, see what these companies are like, but also if you encrypt the data with your own key, and then, you know, you're storing it elsewhere, but the key is kept on your computer, then that means if the government comes and gets that information, they still have to come to you, and you can raise whatever objections you have. They'll get the encrypted bits, but they won't get the key without talking to you.
But what you use to encrypt it also matters too, so you have to research, you know, whether it's TrueCrypt or whatnot. So, yeah.
Is there like any minimum like key length is considered relatively safe these days? Like, 256 bit, 512.
Don't use 256.
Yeah.
It depends what it is. If it's there are a couple different kinds of encryption keys. There's sort of symmetric and asymmetric. So the asymmetric is a public-private key system where you can publish your public key and anyone can encrypt information and only the private key can decrypt it. And then symmetric is where sort of you both know the same key and are encrypting it with that key. And you can have much shorter key lengths with symmetric than you do with asymmetric. So for the asymmetric, I'm probably at least 2048, but maybe 4096. I mean, it depends on how many years you want to have privacy on it. And then for a symmetric one, maybe there you could maybe 256, but I might go 512.
Has anyone here received a national security letter?
Okay. I'll say I have not received a national security letter.
Yeah. What is that?
I'm sorry?
What is a national security
letter? Oh, I'm glad you asked. I had handed one around. There's an example right there. We mentioned that at the beginning of the talk. Essentially, it's an administrative type of thing.
It's a letter, as you can see there, that the FBI can write and send to a service provider to require them to give up certain limited amount of information about an account holder. Usually their name and address, means and source of payment, that sort of information.
Where'd you get the letter from?
I got offline. I think it was ACLU's website.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was for
they
the
have
ACLU
a,
case?
With that case, they have every document if you're interested. The subpoenas that was later unsealed and all that kind of stuff, all the briefs and stuff. So, I'm sorry.
You were mentioning, I have two questions. One's just what's your website? Because you keep mentioning your website. What's the?
Oh, EFF.org.
That's easy enough. And the other one, we went to something the other day, and it said, you know, about the collection of information, and it said they automatically collect everything that's encrypted. I mean, that's one of their pings. Of course, they have automatic for nearly everything. But so how often do you, I mean, you don't want them to peruse through any of your information, so you might want to encrypt it all, but then that flags all of your stuff as being, and even if you go to your...
What she's raising is that when the NSA is collecting material, it's not so much that they necessarily collect everything, they collect everything, but they keep the encrypted material. Instead of having it age off the system. And so this has understandably caused some people to be concerned that you know, they don't want to look suspicious and use encrypted communications. But I would actually rather if everybody was using encrypted so that we're all not suspicious because everybody's doing it. And the truth is that actually you're doing encrypted communications all the time. If you use Google or Facebook, you're using encrypted communications when you're going back and forth with them. If you are going to your bank, or you know, when you're entering in your credit card at Amazon, you're using encrypted communications, and rightfully so. So there are a lot of ordinary people who every day are using encryption, and I think it is much less of a flag for at least web communications. Encryption is getting more and more commonplace on that. For email communications, encryption is becoming more commonplace at the transport layer, but less so, it is unusual end-to-end. And so let me just explain the difference between end-to-end and the transport layer. End-to-end is when you have the key and the other person has the key, but nobody in between can decrypt it. And the transport layer is that in between various hops of computers, it is being encrypted, but the service provider could decrypt it. A lot of things like are encrypted at the transport layer, and that's good for protecting against passive surveillance and also evildoers who want to get your credit card information and such. But to give full security, you want to have end-to-end where you have the key.
I'll comment just a little bit. So you mentioned Amazon. You're technically correct that they do use SSL to protect the credit card information, but when you're just browsing the site,
correct,
they do not. So when you're shopping around and you're looking at whatever, be careful because that could actually be monitored. But if you're worried about this also, there's HTTPS everywhere, or maybe it's SSL
everywhere.
That's
one of our products. Thank you for the plug.
Not a problem. So that'll just make sure that you're always using encrypted communication. So thank you for that.
So he's mentioning HTTPS everywhere. This is a free browser add-on that works with Chrome and Firefox. So you can download it, add it onto your browser. And what it does is we are collecting a list of a lot of websites who have encryption available, but not by default. So that if you ask for it, they will provide it, but And it's kind of a pain to ask for it individually, and so we made a little browser add-on that asks for you. And so for all the ones that can be encrypted, they are. But if they're not offering the encryption, then it's not. And unfortunately, as you said, yeah, with some of the sites, they will encrypt passwords and login and payment information, but for general usage, they're not encrypting it. EFF.org. And it's free.
Going somewhat beyond the legality of the collection information, once the government has all of the emails and the call records and everything like that, it becomes a big data problem. Mm-hmm. And I work in big data, and most people who do suck at big data. What have we seen that gives us any confidence that even having all this information, they're going to be able to make effective use of it?
Not much. I mean, one of the things that came. Certainly, you're right that it's a big data problem. There are estimates that they are drawing in around 30 petabytes a day. It's a lot of data to go through. They just built a gigantic storage facility out in Utah that is 100,000 square feet of server space. And you know, even though storage is becoming cheaper and easier as time goes on, that's still they have a tremendous big data problem. Be that as it may, like on the effectiveness of this, we know with the call detail records program, they started out saying that it was involved in I think it was like 50 or so investigations, and then as people drilled down, it turned out to be less and less and less. And then the current story, as I understand it, is that the call detail programs was able to stop this guy in San Diego who was like a taxi driver who wanted to transfer some money to a Islamic charity in Somalia that was affiliated with terrorists. So we were able to stop that. Yeah, I mean, the big data concern is really also that for false positives, that as they go through things, we'll find information that may look suspicious when it is an ordinary activity, and it's I think we talked about Amazon before, and there are many, many times when Amazon will say, well, if you based on this thing you bought, you might like this other thing, and you know what, I don't like that other thing. That other thing's not that exciting to me. And if this is, a billion-dollar company, hiring the best engineers they can find is able to do with big data, then it suggests that the technology isn't there yet.
It's not mature.
Yeah. But it's one of the things that I think happens with governments is you have a problem. We want to find out who the bad guys are. And then people will come forward with solutions where it's, well, why don't we throw a whole lot of money at my company to solve this problem for you? And so if you have a big, you need to have giant server spaces and build the software to do it. And you have what some people have called sort of the surveillance industrial complex, as sort of a playoff of the military industrial complex. But a lot of really expensive programs and buying hardware and hiring engineers, because that's something that you can do, and if it doesn't come up with that many results, it won't be for lack of spending money on it. And some of these things have been, they've worked on hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars on some of these programs that have not really been all that effective in terms of their results.
I echo that statement. Just kind of a personal story. When I was in student government when I was in college, and I was amazed at just the idea, like people would just say the solution is to throw money at something. And that just amazed me. I was like, really? There's no more thought process behind it just other than throwing money at it? And it's a huge problem. So like with the NSA thing, there was actually a program that was a lot cheaper and more effective. But it actually had programming built into it that it would protect more civil liberties and protect Americans more. But the government opted for the other program that was way more expensive, yet it didn't have any of those protections. So it's that, you know, sledgehammer approach versus a fine-tuned thing. And, you know, they don't want to be, you know, after the fact. I think part of it, it's just the fear after the fact. They don't want to be accused of, you know, being wimps or not truly going after it. But,
well, I mean, if there is a terrorist attack, everyone wants to be not at fault. And one of the ways that you can do that if you're in the executive is always be asking for Congress to give you more money. And then at some point, Congress will say, well, that's enough money. And then if there's an attack, you say, well, if only you had given me more money, we could have. So it's really your fault. You know, so there is sort of a tendency within bureaucracies to ask for more powers, more money, more resources, so that they're always in a situation of being able to say, we didn't have the tools that we needed, so it's not our fault.
But I think that's about it.
All right, I think this has brought us to 11, so thank you all for coming.
Thank you very much.